Ready.
Okay. Does everybody have this or do you remember this? I'll erase it. All right, so thinking about the general context of the book of Hebrews, who's it written to? Jewish believers who had endured to this point some persecution. What kind had they endured so far? Or not endured?
Property seized.
What's that?
They had their property seized.
Okay, they had their property taken away. They had some persecution, but they hadn't yet endured to. Okay, they hadn't endured to the point of shedding blood, but they had endured some at this point. And so he's writing to them a word of what?
Exhortation.
Okay, a word of exhortation. Because apparently since they were enduring some persecution, what were they considering doing? Okay, they were considering going back to what they knew before, the old way, Judaism, because it was easier perhaps to be just a Jew than it was to be a Jewish believer. And so they were considering going back. And so he writes them a word of exhortation. Remember, he says, just a brief word. And his exhortation was primarily about who?
Jesus.
Okay. It's about Jesus. But Jesus, who was their what?
High priest.
He's the great high priest. Why would that have been significant to them?
Because they had sacrificed in the temple, the sacrifices, and because of the sacrifices that they had at that time, with the temple sacrifices.
Yeah, and they had the high priest who was the representative to who for them? Okay, to God. And he's going to point out how that high priest was really inferior to the one we have now. And because of him, they can endure and they can draw near and all those things. So he's telling them, yes, you're suffering, but don't go back. You have Jesus, the great high priest. And then he gives them all of these, not only exhortations, but what else in this book?
The warnings.
Okay, warnings. It is a book that is laced with warnings, and we're going to look at the first one today. And he tells them things that they ought not to do, then he gives them kind of repeated, somebody said that the better than, right? That's a key that goes through the book. See, Jesus is better than all of these Old Testament things. Then he tells them, too, that there's warnings, there's the encouragements of the better than. He exhorts them by calling them to come alongside. What does he say? Sign language.
A little more.
Sounds like.
Yeah, right. But let us, right. He calls them all those let us.
Lettuces.
Yeah, the rows of lettuce. Yeah. Let us. And when he tells, he asks them, let us, what are some of the things he encourages us them to do together? What does he say? Let us do what?
Pay more.
What's that?
Pay better attention.
Okay, pay attention. Not sure that was a let us, that's a good one. Maybe it was. What else?
Hold fast or confidence.
Okay, hold fast. What else?
Fear.
Lest any of you. Yes. Okay.
Be diligent.
Thinking about the high priest, what was the one who repeats over and over? Let us do what?
Draw near.
Mm-hmm. not just draw near, but draw near with confidence, with full assurance of faith. Okay. So, it is a word to the Jewish believers, and we don't know exactly where they're located. There's some hints that have been given in commentaries where it might have been located. It's a word of exhortation. You know, exhortation is encouragement, right? It's a hang in there type of a message. And it's about Jesus, the great high priest, but he's warning them about what could happen if they don't pay attention, if they don't hang on to the word. And he's telling them that Jesus is better than, and then all those let us pay attention and draw near and all that. I'm going to erase this for more. Okay, that's just the warm up. Okay, what was the first segment that we saw in Hebrews? What chapters did that involve?
1 and 2.
Okay. Okay, chapters 1 and 2, and that's what we're on today. And what would be the main thought of chapters 1 and 2?
God has spoken through us from Jesus.
Okay. God spoke in his son.
In his son.
Right. God spoke in his son. All right. So it's really about Jesus. And if you look at chapter 1, which is what we dealt with last week, we have it breaking up, say, verses 1 and 2. What do 1 and 2 talk about?
God used to talk to the prophets.
He used to speak to the prophets in various ways.
Okay, he used to speak to the prophets in various ways. But now he's spoken to us so in the last days, right? In these last days. Spoken to us in the Son. In the next section would be verses 3 and 4. What do we see in verses 3 and 4? Well, Jesus is better than who? Jesus is better than the angels. And then the rest of the chapter explains what? How that works out, right? How he is better than the angels. I'm going to bring all those Old Testament verses to us to listen to so that we can understand why he is better than the angels. And so he says in verse 4 that he's better than the angels because he has inherited a much better name. What's a much better name that he inherited?
Son.
Yes, he is the Son. He says, to which of the angels did he ever say, "You are my son, today I have begotten you"? Has he ever said that to an angel?
No.
No. And again, I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me. So he's saying that the much better name is the name of son. The angels can't even compare to that, though. Even though he might have spoken in the angels, they didn't have that rank and that relationship with him that Jesus did. And then he's given us kind of an idea of what he's going to kind of be talking about when he said in verse 6, what is he saying? In verse 6. Okay, let all the angels of God worship him when? Okay, so he says, and when he again brings the firstborn into the world, he says, let all the angels of God worship him. So what time frame is he looking towards? Okay, the end times, right? He's looking to the time when he will come back to rule as the king. He says, when he again brings the firstborn, the Messiah, into the world, he says, let all the angels of God worship him. And of the angels, he says, who makes his angels winds and ministers a flame of fire. But of the Son, he says, what does he say? Okay, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. So he's talking about the time when Jesus will do what? Will rule. So he starts off with saying, when he brings them into the world again, when he again comes into the world, then he talks about his throne. forever and ever. Okay, so he's looking to the time when he's going to be on the throne, when he brings him into the world, and he's going to be on the throne forever and ever. And he talks about the righteous scepter as a scepter of his kingdom. So he's going to have a kingdom, and it will be ruled in what?
Righteousness.
Be ruled in righteousness. He says, "You have loved righteousness and hated lawlessness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness above your companions." And so when he has his righteous kingdom, who's he going to share it with?
His companions,
right? He'll have companions there. We'll share with him in his righteous, joyful rule. He will be above them. He's anointed above them, but they will be his companions that will share with him in the kingdom. So we think about the future kingdom and the fact that Jesus is going to rule in that kingdom, not the angels. Jesus will rule. He will have companions to rule with him. Let's see, and then verse 10, "You, Lord, in the beginning laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the works of your hands. They will perish, but you will remain. They will become old like the garment, like the mantle. You will roll them up like a garment. They will also be changed, but you are the same, and your years will not come to an end. But to which of the angels has he ever said, 'Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet'?" So where is Jesus now? Okay, he's sitting at the right hand of the Father. And what is he waiting for?
The command to come.
Yeah, he's waiting for all this to happen, isn't he? So right now he's at the right hand of the Father, waiting. Okay, so he's waiting for all these things to come to pass. And then it says, are they who?
Angels.
Are they not all ministering spirits sent out to render service for the sake of those who inherit salvation? So he's saying that they are, the angels have a ministry to the companions, right? Those who will inherit salvation. So they have a ministry to them. And then we have a parenthetical, don't we? If we look at chapter 2, where does the thought from chapter 14 pick up again in chapter 2? Okay, in verse 5. So what is if you take out verses 1 through 4, does the thought continue?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you could just take that little passage out and set it aside, couldn't you? And it wouldn't interfere with the flow of thought at all. But let's take a little look at this parenthetical here. It says, for this reason. For what reason? Okay, because of who Jesus is, for the fact that God has spoken in his Son, and that the Son is going to rule, and he's going to rule with his companions. For this reason, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, so that we do not what?
Drift away.
So what does it mean to pay closer attention, first of all?
Do what it says.
Okay, do what it says. Be mindful, yes.
It's a very intense word. Like, really focus in on it.
Right, very intense. Okay, to pay much closer attention, right? Much closer, not just to pay attention, but much closer attention. It's the idea of focusing and the idea that someone's of actually doing it, right? Okay, to attend to it. Pay close attention to what we have heard so that we do not drift. What does it mean to drift? Okay, to neglect, yeah. It's got a lot of different, it's got the idea of what?
Wandering, slipping,
just kind of slipping away. Slipping right past something. It's got the idea of a ring slipping from the finger. You know, sometimes if you have a ring that's too big, it'll just kind of slip right off. Or flowing past without really paying attention to what's going on. Just that mindless drifting. And like we said before, how much effort does it take to drift?
None.
You can drift without doing anything at all, right? So that's what he's telling them. Don't do that. If you don't pay attention, if you're not giving earnest heed and doing what the word says, what are you going to do? You're going to be set adrift, aren't you? And you can just be going, floating down the river, right past.
One author I read said it's like a pilot list vote.
Right.
You know, if you're not believing in God, you're just out there without a pilot.
Yeah, no moorings, just floating. That's scary, isn't it?
Okay. Pay attention. I also saw mine said it was more of a warning, like beware, too. It wasn't just, oh, by the way. It's a warning.
Yeah, right.
Warren Worsby said if you're not growing, you're going backward, if you know it or not.
Yeah, you're drifting. Yeah.
So you're drifting.
That's a good word, isn't it? If you're not growing, you're going backwards. Okay, so pay attention, to hold fast to it, to keep your attention focused so you don't drift away. And what does the word neglect mean? If we okay. To be careless of, disregard. Okay. So it's actually not, it's a careless mindset. It's actually ignoring or turning yourself away from something. It's not just a passive word. It's something you're actually doing.
And indifferent.
Yes, being indifferent. Right. So he says in this warning, we must pay closer attention to what we have heard so that we do not drift away from it. For if the word spoken through the angels proved unalterable, and every transgression, disobedience received a just penalty, how will we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? So what words was spoken through the angels? What is he referring to here? Okay, the law, right? The law came through the intermediary for, help of the angels. So what is it? What did you learn about that from, was it Acts and Galatians? What does it say?
Incredibly strict penalties.
What's that?
Incredibly strict penalties. Death for cursing and blasphemy and things like that.
Right, the penalty. What was the penalty? Okay, the word, first of all, the word came through the angels was what? It was the law, right? It says Acts 7, Galatians, Deuteronomy. It says Moses, the angel spoke to him where? Okay, on Mount Sinai, where he received the living oracles to pass on to the people. They received the law as ordained by angels, but what? What did he say? By angels, but did they keep it?
No,
they didn't keep it. They understood that it came to them through the angels, which is pretty awesome, right? That's pretty cool. But did they keep it?
No.
And we know that from the history of Israel, they did not keep it. And what did Stephen say in Acts 7:38 and 51 through 53? What's that?
Stiff-necked.
Oh yeah, they're stiff-necked people. They didn't keep.
They killed their prophets.
Yes, they killed the prophets. Tormented them, at least every one of them. Okay. Interesting. Just a little bit of information. When I was looking that verse up, it talked about how they brought out with them from Egypt the star of what was his name now? I can't remember the name of the. Rampa, the star of Rampa, and they worshipped it along with their, you know, offering to Moloch and all that. So I thought, what is Rampa? So I looked it up, and it's of course Saturn, which is one of the bases of all the false worship today. Okay, what was the star of Rampa? You know what the star of Rampa was? It's not the Star of David. It's the Star of Rampa. And that's, you know, one of the deceptions, which I read this wonderful article. I knew this. I've seen enough videos about the star to know it's not anything to do with David. But it goes way back to the worship. And, you know, when Solomon Remember when Solomon turned away from the Lord in the end? What did he do? He worshipped all the idols, and he started off, you know, all those offerings, and of course a lot of it was Moloch and all the different, you know, child sacrifice and all the sex sacrifice and all that. And this was known back then as the seal of Solomon, actually, because he brought this back and brought it into the worship. And so it's a demonic thing, actually, and it was never related anywhere to David. David would never have related himself to something like that. Anyway.
I know, then I wonder how. Because it's identical.
How did it is? It is the same star. That's the thing. That's the point of what I'm saying to you. Is that the Star of David is not the Star of David, and of course it came through the Rothschilds adopted that as their family insignia, and they were of course very instrumental in planting the nation of Israel, and so they adopted the Star of Rampa as their flag. But someday when Israel repents, you know, that one day when they all look at the Lord and they repent, they will not have that star as their flag. That will not, it will not be a dark thing. It will be something to do with the light. It will be something to do with the light. Anyway, very interesting.
How do you spell that?
It's in Acts chapter 7. Let's see. R-O-M-P-H-A. 43. It's when David, or Stephen here, says, "But God turned away and delivered them up to serve the host of heaven, as is written in the book of the prophets. It was not to me that you offered victims and sacrifices 40 years in the wilderness, was it, O house of Israel? You also took along the tabernacle of Moloch and the star of the god Rampa, the images which you made to worship them. I also will remove you beyond Babylon." So he's talking about their apostasy, and then they brought it out of Egypt with them, and they kept it to themselves. They kept it close to their hearts, all of that.
What was that reference one more time?
Acts 7:43. Anyway, the reason I bring this up is because, you know, we studied Revelation, right? And what did we see about Satan? What is he?
Deceiver.
He's the great deceiver. And so when he brings the satanic symbol out and attaches it to David, he is lying to us, because David is the man after God's own heart who would not ever have been attached to something like that. And we think about Solomon and his apostasy, that's where it really belongs. And that's speaking of the apostasy. And, well, I don't want to get off on too much. This is recorded and I don't want to talk about it too much. But the thing that's really been brought to my mind since we've been studying all of this with Revelation is that what is in Israel, I'm not speaking of the people, mind you, not of the people, the Israeli people, but the government that is there is the government that is waiting for the Antichrist, really. You know, the star is, if you take that star apart, it signifies 666. They're waiting for the Antichrist. They want to bring in the one world government. They want to bring in the new world order, because we know that they will not inherit the promises until they do what? Until they repent and they turn to him and they cry out to him, and the nation is born in one day will be a nation that is under the lordship of Jesus Christ as they confess him as their Messiah. And so what they have the land now, but have they done that?
No.
So they're in the land. These things have to happen. They have to be in the land, but they are not the nation the promises are going to come to. It will be the people that repent in the end, okay? So what is there now? And you think about, keep in mind, think about that beautiful star on that, you know, that beautiful blue on the beautiful white. It is a satanic symbol that this government is really working towards. It has nothing to do with bringing in the real Messiah, who will come and who will set up his kingdom there. But we know who has to come first. The Antichrist is to come first. And Jesus said, "You don't welcome me, but there's going to come someone someday." I think this is in Zechariah, I think. "And you will welcome him." So, you know, he's the one they're going to welcome. Anyway, all that to say, we're looking at Hebrews, that Jesus, that God is going to bring him again someday into the world, and then all the angels are going to worship him, and he's going to have fellows that are going to worship and rule with him, and it's going to be a great time. But it's not going to be the angels that rule, it's going to be him who does. And we know when the law came, it came with the angels, because as the covenant was made, this legal thing, the angels represented God's part of things, right? And Moses represented who? the people. He represented the people. So as this covenant was made, we had God and the people entering into this covenant. And did the people keep it?
No.
So we know there had to be another covenant, right? Because that one didn't work because the people didn't keep it. And in the first covenant, if they sinned and we saw all these different opportunities for punishment, was there any negotiation on the punishment?
No.
If they sinned, there was a definite time that they were punished. And a lot of times it was what?
Death.
Okay. And so they set the law of Moses aside. It says, anyone who set aside the law of Moses died without mercy. All right? Okay. So how will we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? After it was first spoken through the Lord, right? Jesus came, God's Son spoke through him. It was confirmed to us by who? Okay, so the person who's writing Hebrew said, Jesus spoke it, and it was confirmed to us by the ones who heard him speak. So the original group there, right? And it said that God also testifying with them, both by what? Okay, and gifts of the Holy Spirit according to his own will. So how did God confirm the word that was spoken through Jesus to the apostles, to the rest of the people? Okay, by works of the Holy Spirit, by signs, wonders, miracles, and they were given to do what again? Okay, to confirm the word and to confirm the people that were actually giving the word. Paul says that it was with signs of an apostle, right? That he was confirmed by the signs of the apostle that were done through him. And so they could trust the word because God authenticated it by the works that he did through them. And so we could look at these signs and wonders and miracles and the gifts that were given as being given in order to really put God's stamp of approval on the message and the messengers that were bringing it. Gave them authority. And so God testified with them using those things. All right. So then he goes on. Well, who's he talking to? Who are the we, first of all? For this reason, we must pay closer attention to what we have heard so that we do not drift. Who is we? Okay. So he's talking to the believers. He's talking, including himself. So we know he's talking, including himself. And he's talking to the Jewish believers. And, of course, he's talking to any among them who may not actually be believers, which might have been possible in those days as well as it is today. We know that today we're looking out at a church and we're thinking, wow, some of these people are saved, but probably a lot of them aren't. You know, there's reasons they're there that have nothing to do with salvation. So that could be talking to unbelievers as well as believers, but he's including himself. So we think the primary recipients would be believers, right? Okay, so he's saying that we don't want to drift away and that there's a consequence if we drift away. If we neglect the way of salvation, there is a consequence. And that's all we can really get from this passage right now, correct? That's what he's saying. So what is he saying? What is it, what's the main message about that warning then?
Pay attention.
Don't drift. You know, hang on to the way, we know what the way of salvation is. Hang on to it. Don't neglect it, because there's consequences. And then going on to verse 5, we're in all this following the rest of the chapter, we're going, just going to go through it, kind of give your observation worksheet on it. We're going to go through briefly to see what it says, but you're going to tear this apart in the next couple weeks, and there's a lot in here. So he's saying at the end, in chapter 1 that Jesus is coming, he's going to bring him back again, and he's going to have a throne that's going to be forever and ever, and he's going to have companions to share the throne with and to share the kingdom with, and they're going to be happy. They're going to be so glad, and they're going to be together. And then he says in verse 5, for he did not subject to angels the world to come concerning which we are speaking. So he's saying, who is going to have rule over this world? Who is not going to have rule over the world? Okay, the angels aren't going to rule. There was some thought back in those days among the Qumran community that the angel, Michael and his archangel, would rule the new age to come. But they would be the ones that would rule. And he says, he did not. He did not ever subject the world to come to angels. And then he moves on in verse 6. and I love this, but one has testified somewhere saying, you're saying last night, it's kind of like we say, it says somewhere in the Bible, I'm not sure where, but this is, I think, Psalm 9, actually, is what he's quoting, but he said, did not subject to angels the world to come concerning what you're speaking, but one has testified somewhere saying, what is man that you remember him, or the son of man that you are concerned about him? You have made him for a little while lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor and have appointed him over the works of your hands. You have put all things in subjection under his feet. So we're going to look at this next week, but he's talking probably about who in this passage?
Jesus.
Ultimately, but who's he primarily talking about? Okay, about man. Right, the angels never had the rule of this world, and even at creation, who did God subject the world to?
Man.
To man. Man was put over the works of God's hands, wasn't he? They were to rule over and to subdue and to, that was our job, to have dominion over this created world. And so God made them lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honor. Really, they did have glory and honor at the time. And put all things in subjection under his feet. And then in verse 8, it gives us a little insight as to what this is really talking about when he says, for in subjecting all things to him, if you put man in there, he left nothing that is not subject to him, but what? Okay. It's not our experience now, is it? We do not see all things subjected to him now. Man is not the one who has dominion. Who did man give the rule of the world to? He gave the rule of the world to Satan, didn't he? He turned it over to the serpent. And so the serpent now has rule. He's the ruler of this world. Correct? We all understand that? It's really important that we really understand that. I mean, it's very important that we understand that.
So everywhere it says him, it really means man.
In this passage.
Unless it's capitalized.
Yeah, that's the editor's way of differentiating.
That's
cheat
for us.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, cheat. Trying to figure out who he's talking about. Okay, so he gave the rule over to Satan, who now is the god of this world. And what do we know about him? What is he? Okay, he's a deceiver. He's a murderer. He's a liar from the beginning. And we have to remember that he is the one that rules this world, the one who has deceived the whole world, lied to everybody. Okay, so we don't see man as the ruler over the world like God intended. But in verse 9, we do see who? Okay, we do see him who was made for a little while lower than the angels. Because what was Jesus' position before?
Higher.
Okay, he's the eternal God, isn't he? Eternal God, existent with the Father forever and ever and ever. But he was made for a little while lower than the angels, namely who? Jesus, right? This is his human name. Namely, this is the first time he's named in this book. So, namely Jesus. So the one who has been made lower than the angels is now became a human being, namely Jesus. And why did he become a human? What was the purpose of him becoming human in verse 9?
To taste
death for everyone. So because he became a human because of the suffering of death. Crowned with glory and honors that he might taste death for everyone. And so we see that to get to the point where we have in verse 8 in chapter 1, where we have him being anointed with the oil of gladness above his companions, to get to the point where he's going to have companions in the world to come in his kingdom, what do you have to do first? He had to become a man to die for those companions so they could share in his glory. Otherwise, no hope. He'd be all by himself in the kingdom. So it says in verse 10 that it was fitting for him, for who is him?
Jesus.
Jesus.
I'm just thinking, man gave the world up to Satan, so Jesus had to come and be a man to get it back.
That's right. Isn't it just a great story? It is such a great story. Really just a great story. Okay, so it's fitting for Jesus, for him, for whom are all things, and through whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to perfect the author of their salvation through... Oh, it's fitting for God, the Father there, I'm sorry. for whom and through whom are all things, in many bringing many sons to glory, to perfect the author of their salvation through suffering. So that word author is the idea of being the captain. He's the captain, he's the head, he's the beginning, he's the author. So he's the one to go before, to, you know, to head up the big group here. He had to suffer. Now, what does it mean to perfect the author of their salvation through suffering? Was there something lacking in him?
No.
No. So what does that mean, to perfect?
It's to complete it.
To complete.
Okay, to complete. There's something that needed to be completed before he could do what he had to do as the author of salvation, as the captain of the troops. He had to suffer first. Why did he have to suffer? Right, so he could help us, right? He could, without having gone through human suffering, he could not really relate to the humans that he was going to have in his group if he didn't suffer first.
To be our perfect high priest.
Yeah, to be our perfect high priest, he had to suffer. So it wasn't just to buy us, it was to relate to us too, to be able to help us. It says, for both he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified are all from one Father. So Jesus is from the same Father that the companions are, right? Those who are sanctified and the one who sanctifies, we're all from the same Father, for which reason he's not ashamed to call them brethren. And like I say, we're going to study all this more. He is not ashamed to call us brethren, saying, I will proclaim your name to my brethren. In the midst of the congregation, I will sing your praise. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, behold, I and the children whom God has given me. So he's saying that he himself will sing the praises of God. And who did Jesus have to entrust himself to in verse 13? Who did he have to entrust himself to? To God the Father. So he had to do the same things that the children are going to have to do. As he was on this world and on this earth and he was suffering and being tempted, he entrusted himself to his Father. What do we do when we're going through trials and temptations and suffering on this earth? We have to entrust ourselves to God. And so he's that captain that went before us and showed us that you can do it. You can trust the Lord. You can trust the Lord through the hard times and through the suffering. He's shown how it can be done. And he's not ashamed to call us brethren. And then in verse 14 it says, therefore, since the children share in flesh and blood, what kind of creatures are we? Okay, we're flesh and blood. We're made of dust, aren't we? He himself likewise also partook of the same. So what did he have to do once again? Okay, he had to be flesh and blood, just like us, didn't he? If he was going to be our brothers, he had to be just like us. He had to take on that flesh and blood, that through death he might render powerless him who had the power of death. That is who?
The devil.
So we go back to the beginning, to the man giving it over and Satan now having control. And now Jesus says that through his death, he rendered him powerless. Did he destroy him?
No.
We saw when that's going to happen, didn't we? We studied Revelation. We saw the end when he'll be thrown into the lake of fire forever and ever. But what did he do? What does it mean that he rendered him powerless? Okay, he's powerless over us, isn't he? The children who are brethren with Jesus, who share with him, Satan has no power over us any longer. And we have to understand that Satan does not have power over us. For greater is he that is in us than he that is in the world. So Satan has no power over us. He has no authority over us. Don't think that he does. Do not believe that he does, because he does not. He does not have power over us. Okay, he rendered him powerless, who had the power of death, that is the devil. And when he did that, he says he might free those who through what?
Fear of death.
Okay, who through fear of death were
sent to be free all their lives.
All their lives. And you think about the world now, and think about the people that walk around this world that do not know the Lord. What are they? What are they? They're slaves. They are slaves because they are held in power by who?
Satan.
Satan because of their fear of death. So they'll make deals, they'll do things that they shouldn't do because they're afraid to die. He has that over them. He hangs it over them, and they'll make bad choices and do things, sin, because they don't want to die. They are slaves. Slaves to the fear of death. It's such a sad thing all of their lives. All of their lives. But we have been set free. Isn't that just great? We aren't. We have no fear of death anymore. I think about Paul, when Paul was talking, is it Philippians, where he's saying, well, I think I might die, but I can't really decide which to choose, because if I die, it's really better. I'll go to be with the Lord, and that is just so fabulous. But if I stay here, then I can help you, and that's really good for you. So whatever, you know, to be with the Lord here is all great.
Somewhere it
says, perfect love casts out fear. And love is the greatest, isn't it? You know, love, we choose to love. Okay. Anyway, this is so great. So we are not in slavery to the devil anymore. And we are not, he has no power over us. We are not bound to him by our fear of death anymore. And then he says, assuredly, he does not give help to angels, but he gives help to the descendant of, or the seed of Abraham. So who does Jesus help in his death? When he came to earth to die, to become a man, who does he give help to?
Me.
Yeah, it's to me, it's to you, it's to all of it, to those who are the seed of Abraham. Of course, here he's talking primarily to the Jewish people, but we know that as believers, we are part of the seed of Abraham, aren't we? And so he gives help to us. He doesn't give help to the angels. The angels don't need the same kind of help that we do they? They don't even understand it, really. Okay, it says, therefore, he had to be made like his brethren in all things. And so how was he made like us again? Okay, he was flesh and blood, and when he was on this earth, what did he do? Okay, he suffered and died, and what else?
Rose again,
right? We can't really relate to that right now, but he was just a man here, wasn't he? He was hungry. He had to sleep, he got sick, all those things that we do, everything. He did the same things that we do, but he didn't sin. He endured temptation without sinning, but he endured it nevertheless. So he had to be made like us in all things so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. So what is it to make propitiation? Okay, what do we deserve?
Death.
Okay, we deserve death. But propitiation has the idea that God is over here, and what is God like? Okay, he's holy, right? And what are we? Okay, we're sinful, and so because of that, what is between us? Okay, there's a chasm. There's enmity between us, right? God can't be nice to us because we are sinners and he is holy, so he can't be nice to us. So when he made propitiation, he paid for it all. Jesus paid for all of that. So now when God looks at us, what does he see?
Jesus.
And so is there enmity any longer between those that belong to him and him? No, there's no more enmity. There's no more division between us. So God has moved from being, we are moved from being his enemies to now being his children and has been friends, right? So that's what he did. He removed that separation for us. And he could do that as the high priest, right? For since he himself was tempted in that which he has suffered, he is able to do what? Okay, come to the aid of those who are tempted. So not only did he make the propitiation, remove that strife between us and God, but he also now, as our high priest, he gives us help. Right? He knows he has been through it. He can help us now. He is that faithful high priest who's experienced everything we have, and he can be our help. Angels don't need the help, do they? But we do. We really need help. So he is able to come to the aid of those who are tempted, and we're going to see much more about his high priesthood as we move on through the book of Hebrews, because it's one of the main thoughts that we have this high priest. We have this one who has gone beyond the veil and is at the right hand of the Father, making intercession for us and helping us. We can draw near with confidence to receive help, right? So we go to the throne and we ask for help. So is it a weak thing to ask God for help?
No.
He is at the right hand of the Father waiting for us to come and ask him for help. So we ought to do it. We ought to draw near with confidence, full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled clean. Okay. Any questions about this lesson that we didn't cover?
Is the star, are there two stars in Israel, the star of David and the star of Lampa, or is that Lampa, is the star of David actually an idol?
Well, the saying is that that star was never the star of David. That is Satan's lie. Because Satan was the man after God's own heart. That is always, think of the pentagram. It's connected with all kinds of demonic stuff. It's never been connected to David. It's a lie. That's what I'm just saying. And I'm just wanting, I guess I can't get over saying this often enough. Satan is the father of lies. He deceives the whole world, and the whole world is under his sway. And so many things that we think are one thing, we need to not take anything without really